This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Two new exhibits at the Gregg Museum at North Carolina State University highlight the power of textiles and clothing to shape human identity. Textiles of Exiles highlights the ingenuity of people forced to flee their homes. The other exhibit is called Barkcloth, Bras, and Bulletproof Cotton, The Powers of Costume. And it chronicles the way different cultures and eras use clothes as a form of communication. The exhibit's going to be at the Gregg Museum of Art and Design through May 12th. Roger Manley is here, director of the Gregg Museum. Welcome. Good to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Where'd the idea come from for these exhibits?
Well, there are two different ideas. One is that one show, that the Barkcloth Bras and Bulletproof Cotton show, was a show that we thought would help show off our collection. I think people don't realize that the Gregg Museum has a very large collection of textiles and clothing and that sort of thing, as well as 20,000 other kinds of objects, ceramics, furniture, photography. It's really got a big collection, but often we just show one aspect of that collection, and we thought this would be a chance to cut through the sort of strata and show clothing as well as photographs and paintings and drawings and things that were all connected with the idea of how clothes affect the way the effect that you have on the world and the kind of powers that you have.
I was really hoping you were going to say that you had a dream one night and you woke up and wrote down the word Barkcloth, Bras, and Bulletproof Cotton, and then...
Well, we did try to come up with a catchy title.
It was great. So tell us about this. I mean, what's the scope? How far back do we go, and what kinds of ideas do we see reflected in these clothing?
As far as how far back we go, the oldest things in the show are Peruvian and Egyptian Coptic things, and they go back to... Some of the Peruvian clothing that we have on display goes back to 400 BC, and the Egyptian Coptic stuff to some of the earliest Christian communities, which were in about 400 AD. And in both cases, this clothing was preserved, or the fragments of the clothing was preserved, because they were in very dry, cool, well, in Egypt, not cool, but both were in very dry climates where the textiles would be preserved for a long time. That's the range in terms of time. Range in terms of the cultures is all over the world. I mean, we really looked at what we could draw out of the vast numbers of things that we have and try to, you know, put them together to make the most sense as far as the show goes, and try to show as many different ways that clothing can affect us.
And it really hasn't been unconscious ever. I mean, if you go back to those earliest costumes or clothing, the articles that you have, people were always very conscious of the image they were projecting with the clothes that they were creating, right?
Right. I mean, we actually, the introduction to the show even talks about Adam and Eve and how the very first thing they did after they became knowledgeable, after they ate of the tree of knowledge, the first thing they did was make some aprons out of fig leaves and cover themselves up. We wanted to show that it wasn't very long after that before people realized that clothes could do a lot more than just provide a little privacy. They could express who you were, what you were trying to do, what was your status in life, what tribe you belonged to, all kinds of things like that.
So give us an example. I think one of the more interesting examples is the shaman costume that you show.
Yeah, we have a shaman costume from Africa, along with the mask that goes with it, and a photograph that shows that kind of costume in use. And I think what was amazing to me about, I actually had a chance to film several years ago in Africa, in Benin, in a similar kind of situation, and how the clothing really does transform people. And in this case, I was in Benin filming a ceremony called the Agungun ceremony, where the dancers or the performers wear very, very heavy costumes, almost like wearing layers of carpeting on yourself, and they would spin and spin and spin, and the dance went on and on and on for hour after hour. I was completely hot, completely drenched in sweat, and drinking water, you know, every 2 minutes. Eventually, I turned to the translator who was working with me, and I said, "Don't these people ever get tired? I mean, don't they ever get thirsty?" And you know, it had been about 4 or 5 hours of nonstop movement. And he turned to me, and he looked very surprised, and he said, oh, no, they don't get tired. They're dead. And I said, what do you mean? He says, these are the ancestors, and they're dead. And, you know, to him, the transformation of the clothing, by putting on those costumes, the people had actually become the dead ancestors. Yeah. To the extent that they really didn't have bodily needs like the living do. They weren't thirsty and they didn't get tired anymore.
But, you know, as exotic as that sounds when you tell that amazing story, mm-hmm. it's true, though, isn't it? I mean, we sort of, you know, if you're going to look important, you got to dress important.
We
dress for success. We do change our persona depending on what we're wearing.
Sure. I mean, there's a reason that dictators wear all those medals and epaulets and things mm-hmm. like that, because it gives them a sense of that kind of, you know, the uniform gives them the power to stand up in front of a crowd of thousands of people and tell them what to do. And, you know, a similar example, if you have a police uniform and you step out into traffic, anybody could wear a police uniform, step out into traffic and hold up their hand, and the cars are going to stop. If you're stepping out in front of traffic in your pajamas, they're not going to stop. And it's only the clothes that have changed. So it's, you know, how they affect you that way.
And also, what's interesting, too, about the exhibit is the way our ideas about clothes have changed. I think the wedding dress probably is the best example of sort of what we've imposed as the meaning for clothing,
right,
and how that's changed over time.
Well, we have a selection of wedding dresses. Those are costumes that people typically wear just one day, and it's a costume that sets aside the person who's wearing it as the bride or the groom, and during that day, you know, they're sort of put in control, queen for a day. And we have a wedding costume from the 1880s. That is, it's a sort of a dark greenish color, and people are always amazed, like, you know, did they wear green back then? And we say, yeah, they wore, up until the wedding of Queen Victoria, people wore whatever they wanted to the wedding. They just wore a nice dress, and then after the wedding was over, they would keep on wearing it to other nice occasions. But starting with Queen Victoria, she had some lace and she had some pearls that she thought would look good with a white outfit. So she asked for a white wedding, and when she got married to Prince Albert, they sent photographs of their wedding all over the world, and suddenly everybody wanted a white wedding like Queen Victoria, because at the time she was the most famous person in the world. And then over time, that whole idea of a white wedding sort of acquired its own folklore, and people began saying, well, the white is for virginity, and, you know, and it
symbolizes
purity, and it's all made up. I mean, there's really no such thing. You actually could wear whatever you wanted and be very traditional.
But what's amazing is that this is considered a tradition and that anyone would think it goes back centuries, if not millennia.
Right, right. And, you know, it's the the actual color associated with virginity is blue, if you really want to get authentic about it. And that's why the Virgin Mary is always shown wearing a blue outfit in medieval paintings and things.
How did that association get made?
Who knows?
Okay.
These things are just decided by, you know, like a Ouija board. Everybody's got their hand in the middle of the thing and pushing, you know, folklore. Yeah. Emerges out of the pressures coming at it from every direction.
So we got to get to the bulletproof cotton, that's for sure. Tell us about that.
Well, bulletproof cotton refers, I mean, we just looked for a catchy title. We wanted people to come see the show.
Yeah.
We thought if we said something like clothing down through the ages, nobody would be bothered with it. But the bulletproof cotton refers to one garment that we have that is worn by gangsters in Thailand. And the gangsters in Thailand, there's a belief that certain kinds of tattoos or drawings done on your body by powerful Buddhist monks can render you bulletproof. Now, if you're going in the army, you're doing something sort of legitimate, you might actually have those things tattooed on your body, I mean directly on your skin. But the Thai gangsters wear these shirts that are covered with similar tattoos. The shirts themselves are tattooed, but the idea is that if you're caught by the police, you can throw away the shirt at the last moment and no one will know that you've been engaged in an activity where you thought you might get shot. So it's a kind of You know, it's a way of having a disposable
double
tattoo.
Double protection. It's protection when it's on and protection when it's off.
Yeah, and they do believe that it's bulletproof.
Well, let's get to the other exhibit, Textiles of Exile. What's the concept behind this?
Textiles of Exile is a show that looks at how people all over the world have responded to being displaced by making things out of the immediate materials at hand. And in most cases, the immediate materials at hand are fibers. People, if you're being, if you're having to evacuate an area very quickly, and we start off with, because I didn't want to get people to thinking of it only in political terms, but we start off in Haiti with people who just two years ago were evacuated because of the earthquake. You know, when they were in their refugee camps, waiting out the, you know, for their homes to be rebuilt or made safe, they've begun making these beaded objects, working with cloth. But when you're suddenly having to leave an area in a very big hurry, you don't grab up your pottery kilns or turning wheels or your blacksmith shop or anything like that. You just run. And so when you get to wherever you're running to, often all you have is the clothes on your back, literally. And yet that's fibers, and people can, if they want to make something to express what they're feeling, they either work with the clothes that they have, or they have cloth of some sort, or they can make a needle by sharpening a bone and poking a hole in the other end of it and that sort of thing. It's really the oldest form of human creativity is working with fiber, because we all go around with fibers on our head. We don't all go around with flint nodules at our feet. So, you know, even though we refer to the old ages as the Stone Ages, that's really only because the stone is what has survived from millions of years ago, right, or tens of thousands of years ago.
So, but it raises the question, though, whether or not people in exile, people forced to leave their homeland, are using textiles as an expression of what they're feeling now, or a kind of recreation of home, a rendering of the clothing or the tapestries that would remind us of home.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think people are doing an activity that is time-consuming. Working with textiles is very time-consuming, and often what these people do have is a whole lot of time, and we have examples of people in prison as well as people in refugee camps. Often people are in these camps for years before they, you know, anything else happens. They have time. They don't have many materials to work with, yet they want to engage in something that is comforting, something that they're used to, something that calls back, you know, the place that they lost. Something that helps them deal with the situation that they're in, and also there's a kind of an age-old connection between doing stuff with fibers and storytelling. The beginning of that show, or the entrance to that show, there's a wall text that talks about how spinning cloth spinning yarn in its most primitive stage actually takes four hands, because you can twist material, you can twist the fibers into a yarn and, you know, make it into a long thread. But to keep adding to it, you have to be able to hand that off to someone else who would actually keep track of the growing ball of yarn. So just that act of two people sitting together doing something encourages a kind of storytelling between the two. And that, so it's no mistake that in Greek and Roman and pagan mythology that the fates are always shown as the storytellers who are weaving. You know, the thread of life and that sort of thing.
We have a large population of Hmong people in North Carolina. They're represented in some of these works. What do we learn from their story and their work?
Well, the Hmong that came to North Carolina came here following the Vietnam War. Many of them were allied with the American forces during the Vietnam War. And because of that, when we pulled out, when the war ended, we left, they were left at the mercy of the people who were then in charge, which were their enemies. And the enemies basically forced them into exile, killed quite a few of them, I think 50,000 Americans died in Vietnam, but something like 120,000 Hmong died in Vietnam. And
in Laos.
Laos. Yeah. And then they made their way to, those who could made their way to Thai refugee camps in Thailand, where quite a few of them have now moved to the United States. North Carolina has the fourth largest population of Hmong former refugees, now settled immigrants becoming American citizens. Many of them are already American citizens. And we wanted to include that story. And in their textiles, they've told the story of what happened to them because, you know, it's a story that not many people know.
Also, you mentioned people in prison, another form of exile, and there's a remarkable exhibit of work done by one inmate in particular, the Golden Venture paper folding pieces.
Right? Yeah, this was a ship of Chinese immigrants or would-be immigrants who were trying to enter the United States. It was not long after the Tiananmen Square revolt, President Bush, the first President Bush, had announced that any Chinese who could make it to the U.S. would be welcomed as refugees. So he came, many people did come, and quite a few boatloads of people came. This one boatload was one of the last to leave China. Unfortunately, they had to stop off several places along the way, and by the time they made it to the U.S., President Clinton had become the president and was being accused of being soft on immigration, although it was his predecessor who had actually welcomed the people in. And so that was one bit of misfortune. The other was that they missed the mouth of New York Harbor in the night and ran aground on the shore of Rockaway Beach near Queens. All of them were arrested. Some drowned trying to get out of the boat, but the rest were arrested, and they spent 4 years in American prisons waiting to be shipped back to China. And during that time, they began this form of origami, which is absolutely incredible. They again, taking whatever they had, and in this case, they were being flooded with legal documents, which they couldn't read. So rather than that, they tore up the legal documents in little bits of paper and folded them into these incredible, absolutely ornate examples of origami. It's far beyond any kind of origami you've ever seen. They made about 10,000 objects and mostly used them to give away to the lawyers and people who were trying to help them. And we show a few of those things. And that kind of paper folding, which was really begun by this group of people, is now called Golden Venture paper folding, which is it's like origami on steroids. It's really an amazing thing to see.
It was not enough to keep them here, however.
No, it wasn't enough to keep them here.
They did go back. Well, there are lots more stories and lots more. You know what? I've got to, if you can do it, give me the 30-second version of the ramen noodle exhibit. I think that would
Be great. Do have a few examples of works made by prisoners in the correction systems, and a couple of the objects we have are a tote bag and a jewelry box made completely from thousands and thousands of bits of ramen noodle packs. And when you first see them, they're incredible. They look like they're made out of tile or some kind of exotic material, but you look up close and it's actually the barcodes torn off of packages of ramen noodles and folded into these incredible objects.
If we can get the WUNC logo on that, those tote bags are going to be at the next fundraiser.
I think that'd be great.
So much. Roger, thank you for being on the program. Great
thank
exhibit.
You so much.
Thanks for being here. Roger Manley, director of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at NC State. The museum's hosting the exhibits Textiles of Exile and Bark Cloth, Bras, and Bulletproof Cotton, The Powers of Costume. All of it goes through May 12th, and you can get more information at ncsu.edu/Gregg. Gregg spelled with two G's. And they're on Facebook. Next up, we remember guitar innovator and teacher Howard Morgan. Stay with us on The State of Things.